My name's Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. I want to talk a little bit about what very possibly might have been the two most important steps in my recovery, and the two most feared steps. The fear about step 8 and 9 was so horrendous that I remember many, many occasions in the years I relapsed and in the time of my early sobriety where I would be in meetings and people would talk about the immense steps, and I felt like, what's the use? I might as well just bolt out of here. I'm never gonna be able to do this. It was too big. And it's not that I didn't understand the value in making the amends. I didn't argue with that. And I could see how you people in AA, it was a good thing for you. I mean, I could tell by looking at you, there were some of you that probably got drunk and said something unkind to your wife. Maybe you had an indiscretion in a bar with a girl, and you should try to make that right. Maybe you padded your expense account, and you should probably make that right. Build character, good for you. But I lived like an animal on the streets. I robbed so many people. Oh my, it was a way of life for me. I wasn't a gangster, even though there was a time I fancied myself a gangster until the police explained I was a public nuisance. But it was petty stuff. You know, I'd steal somebody's purse, or I'd break into your car if it was unlocked and steal your 8-track player, or, you know, that dates me a little bit, or anything that was in there that was value. If you had a set of golf clubs in your back seat, I'd steal them and sell them. If you had a briefcase, I would steal that. I'm the guy who at the bar, I'm drinking and I run out of money. I always run out of money. I have a bad time keeping money. And I'd run out of money, and you'd go to the bathroom, and you'd leave your drink and some change on the bar. Well, when you came back, it's disappeared, right? I mean, I'm not a gangster. I'm a pathetic guy. I can't tell you how many people I ripped off. I used to sell catnip to people. I sold opium incense. I sold crazy little pills that were nothing as all kinds of things that weren't, they weren't. That was a way of life for me. There was a guy, to this day, I've never found him, who was at one time my only friend I had left, and I, in a blackout, I took a knife with a blade about this long, and I opened up his chest. Mm. I've never found him, and not from a lack of looking, I've looked. Unfortunately, I had a childhood full of love. And it's a burden. Because when you do to your parents that loved you, see, if my parents would have been jerks, or if they would have been abused me, then it wouldn't have been so bad. But see, all they ever did was love me. And I seemed to punish him for it over and over and over again. Until by the time I got sober, several years before I got sober, my parents were forced for their own survival to literally push me out of their life. They would not take my phone calls. I was not welcome in their house. They would have nothing to do with me. And they could cut me out of their life, but they couldn't cut me out of their heart. And so I found out through my sister that my father slept 15 hours a day and my mother saw a therapist and took medication. And I knew who did that to them. I knew it. I'd stolen so much from my father so often that he became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop in the town we live in from buying his own crap back. And then the guy cut me off when they became friends. And I did that. There were guys that went to prison as a result of me. because I got put between a rock and a hard place, and I was sick, and I'm withdrawing from alcohol and a bunch of other stuff, and they had me in a room, and they told me I was going to go to prison, and all these other guys are going to go to prison, and they were going to convince these other guys that I dimed them out unless I rolled on. So I did the thing that made me hate myself the most. So how am I ever going to make amends to all those people? It was too big. I just might as well drink myself to death, except I can't. You know, that this my favorite line in the one of my favorite lines in the book, it says, we have two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, or to accept spiritual help. I'd have done number one, looked like a better deal. If I could have stayed blotted out 24/7 until it killed me, sign me up. I'm there. The worst part of alcoholism is whether you want to or not, you're forced periodically to get sober. I mean, well, you run out of money, you get arrested, I mean, you get so physically sick, you can't. I used to get to that point where I couldn't keep it down anymore. I'd have to end up in a hospital afraid of seizures and stuff. So whether I couldn't, I'd not for the lack of trying, if I could have had my way, I'd have just blotted me out until it killed me. I couldn't do it. And so here I am, I have nowhere to go, there's no more relief in the bottle, and I can't live without it. You guys are convincing me slowly that my only hope is to do all this stuff, and it seemed overwhelming. And, you know, this, my reluctance to doing step 8 and 9 is inherent in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in a sense, AA was founded based on one man's 8th step, Dr. Bob Smith. Mother's Day weekend, 1935, Bill Wilson met with Dr. Bob Smith and introduced him through his own experience to this program, and Bob loved it. He liked it all. He loved prayer and meditation. Good, sign me up. Confession of shortcomings. Oh, yeah, that's testifying to people. Helping others. Sign me up. The amends, he says. No, Bill, no. Not the amends. And he dug his heels in and he tried to say, well, you know, I've been a doctor in this town and I've already hurt my reputation. Let's just leave that alone. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith drank again. And what was originally believed to be June 10th, 1935, now there's some historians that are convinced, because of the records of the medical convention in Atlantic City, that it was really June 17th. But regardless, we celebrate Dr. Bob's birthday as June 10th, 1935. Dr. Bob Smith came off his last drunk, and he was sick, and he was shaken, as I would get when you drink round the clock for oblivion, when you got that phenomenon of craving, and you just slam it. And he got sober, and he comes to, and he's got those tremors, and he says, "What day is it?" And he's told, and he says to Bill and to his wife Ann, he says, "My God, I got a surgery to perform this morning," and he's like this. Bill doesn't know what to do. The guy's all prepped, and he's down at St. Thomas Hospital, all prepped and ready to go. And they don't know what to do. They're saying, not Akron City Hospital, rather, ready to go. So Bill gives him some sedative and a couple bottles of beer and sends him into the surgery. Imagine being that patient. Yeah. Watch your laying there, getting prepped, and your surgeon comes in and his hands are going like this and he smells like beer. That would instill a lot of confidence in you. And Bob was a proctologist, so you can kind of use your imagination what kind of surgery it was. Evidently it wasn't a long surgery, because he went in that morning and it was still morning when the surgery was over. And all we know is that the patient lived. We don't know the details. I know a couple historians that have looked through the hospital records trying to figure out more details because, well, I understand. I'd like to know. I mean, we know the guy lived, but did he whistle when he walked or smell what? We don't know. We have no idea. So Dr. Bob Smith got out of that surgery and still in the morning and disappeared. Did not come back to the house on Ardmore Street. And Bill's there, and Ann, his wife, is there, and his son, Smitty, and Smitty sat in my living room and told the story to us. And how everybody was worried, and how everybody assumed that he went on a drunk. I would assume that. He didn't come back all that morning, all that afternoon, and all that evening. His son said it was probably close to midnight by the time Dr. Bob came back to the house on Ardmore Street, and he was not drunk, and he had not been drinking. As a matter of fact, there seemed to be something different about him. And what he'd been doing is he'd spent the whole morning, afternoon, and evening searching out everyone he was afraid to face. And this is the part of the book where in italics it reminds us. It says, remember that we agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Somehow, the willing to go to any lengths thing has gotten twisted around over the years to mean crazy stuff. Like it means, if you go to a discussion meeting and put out the topic, willing to get it to any lengths, most of the people will talk, make it sound like it, well, it's being willing to not drink, go to meetings. Willing to go to any lengths came from Dr. Bob's experience when he was finally willing to go to any lengths. In other words, are you willing to walk through your fear? Are you willing to face those people that you don't know what they're going to do? You don't know if they're going to have you arrested. You don't know if they're going to take a baseball bat to you. You're going to have to pay them money, and it's not like you have too much. Are you really serious about this thing or not? Because, you know, pretty much up until step 8, there's nothing AA asks you to do that's high risk. There's some stuff that's a little inconvenient. There's stuff that maybe you don't, you know, like the fifth step. But you know how we are. We don't take a fifth step blindly. We usually check the guy out first. We know where he lives. We know where his kids are, in case he tells us. You know, we check him out. We know he's not a gossip. The book suggests that. Make sure they're a closed-mouthed person. Keep a confidence. Not very much risk. But here's where self is threatened. Are we really willing to go to any lengths? I think this is the first time that some of us have to actually set ourselves aside and trust in something that we don't even know if it's going to work or not. I think that was the big turning point for Dr. Bob, and it was the big turning point for me. I think most of us will face something somewhere in our early sobriety where it says we stood at the turning point. Mine was when I was about 60 days sober, roughly. And on my back in Pennsylvania, I'd been arrested for a felony hit-and-run DUI in a stolen car. And I went before a judge after I'd been in jail because I couldn't get out on bail. I spent several months in jail until I went before this judge who sentenced me to 2 years in the state penitentiary. And then he stayed the commitment, which means that you're committed. I'm sentencing you to 2 years. We're going to not carry out that commitment. We're going to stay it. We're going to put it on hold. And we're going to stick you in this treatment center. If you can stay in there for a year, get good urinalysis, which is UA's, good PO report. If you can make the restitution, it was considerable. We'll take a look at it. Maybe you'll be free. Misdemeanor, time served, etc. Done. If not, 2 years. Well, I can't stay sober the year in the treatment center. I can't follow that through. Not because I didn't want to. Lack of power really is my dilemma. And I went on what was to be my last drunk I tried to commit suicide on, and I ended up in Las Vegas. Now I'm 60 days sober, and this is haunting me. And I'm starting to incur a big squirmy ball of anxiety, worrying over what's going to happen. Are they going to catch me? You know, etc. And I went and I talked to a guy, an old-timer in AA, and I told him about it. And one of the things that always perplexes me about AA, see, I was a counselor, and I've had a lot of treatment, and I've had a lot of therapy. And I really get the value in talking things out. And then, this big word back then was ventilate. And I see there's a lot of value in that. But the people in AA don't value that. They're more into action, which is kind of offensive to me, really. And I talked to this guy trying to ventilate, hoping I'll feel better, reduce some of my anxiety, but I'm ventilating. And he starts right on me about what I have to do. Now, I don't really want to do anything. I want to talk. But he wants me to take action. And he says, well, here's what you have to do, kid. You have to contact your PO and contact the courts and offer to go back there at your own expense and do the 2 years. And, hey, they may want to tack on some time. How many state lines did you cross in Flint? When you've got to be willing to do all that. And I'm looking at him like, you're out of your goddamn mind. You want me to go to jail? You want me to go to prison? And I remember saying to him, I said, but I got a sponsor and I'm sober and I'm going to meetings. This is good. He said, kid, you're going to die of alcoholism if you don't do this. He said, he backed me right into a corner. He said, how long do you think you're going to stay sober? Looking over your shoulder. How long are you going to stay sober? You can't even use a Social Security card. You can't even use your number. You can't get a driver's license. Every time a cop goes down the street, your gut's going to cinch up because you don't know if he's got your picture on his dashboard or not. Kid, how long are you going to go before the anxiety of that is going to drive you to pick up a drink or some kind of medication? How long? And he backed me right to a corner, man. I knew what he was saying was right, and I didn't like it. This is really a dilemma. A dilemma is where there's only two alternatives, and you can't stand either one of them. Right? It's like, die an alcoholic, death, live on spiritual principles. Give me another choice, for God's sakes. Right? And so he walked me through it. Told me to write a letter to my PO, tell him in the PO. He told me to give him the address of the halfway house. I thought that was a bad idea. I said to him, well, they can pick me up then. He said, yeah, that's right. Jeez. Give me the address. I wrote the letter, gave him the address, told him I'd call my PO in 10 days. He said, give him 10 days. That way he'll get the letter and figure out what they want to do with you before you call them. And I wrote that letter, I showed it to him, he liked it, he said, yeah, it's a good letter. I took it to the mailbox, dropped it in the mailbox. The minute I dropped it in there, I'm trying to get my arm put in the mailbox, I can't get my arm in, I want to get that letter back. My head blew up, I thought, oh my God, I was panicked. What have I done? They got the address, I got to get out of here, I got to pack, I got all, and I was like, crazy. And people in AA convinced me I can't run. Toughed out those 10 days, oh my God. I could hardly sleep. The anxiety level was unbelievable. I'm having bad dreams about whether I'm going to be able to be adjust to being married to Bubba in jail. I don't know. I don't jail well. I mean, I got physical scars from fights I've been in jail, man. Long 10 days. 10 days. 10th day came. I remember going to the phone. I was shaking inside. And I'm horrified. I'm just so scared. And I called. This woman answers the phone. She says, I'll put you right through. He's expecting your call. She puts me through, and a man got on the phone that I really didn't know very well. I'd only talked to him a few times. He had no reason to do anything nice for me. And he got on the phone and he said, I've talked to my supervisor, we've talked to the court, and you don't have to come back here in 2 years to do the 2 years, but here's what you have to do. And he gave me a list of stuff. I had to go to the CRS and go to these classes. I had to report to a guy who was going to be supervising my case. It was being transferred to Nevada. I had to send them money. I had to get urinalysis for a while. I had to do a bunch of stuff. But it was all stuff I could not only do, I had a problem with none of it. I could all do it very easily. I remember hanging up that phone, and I tell you, I don't know if I want to laugh or cry. I had this emotion come over me that was just like I was high on something. It was unbelievable. And it was like my first postcard from God. A God that I don't even believe in. And the postcard just said, "Dear Bob, we got your back. Love God." And it was the first time in my life I ever put myself at risk to serve something greater than myself, to trust something greater than myself. It was the first time. I'm too self-obsessed. I'm too full of self-centered fear. I'm too self-serving. But I guess I was desperate enough to make that leap. I see guys every year that get to that turning point and they can't do it. And they go back and they drink themselves to death. I've seen it over and over again. We were sitting around, a bunch of us all sober, double digit, talking one time. And everybody at that table had a time in their sobriety where it came down to that. It came down to that line in the book where it says, "Crushed by self-imposed crisis, we cannot postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is either everything or He's nothing. Either is or isn't. What's our choice to be?" I think every one of us, somewhere in our early sobriety, somewhere, will get to that choice. Sometimes it's late in sobriety. Sometimes you're sober with untreated alcoholism for 15 years, and you're all of a sudden you're crushed by self. But we all get to that point where we have to. It's either we're in or we're out. What are we going to do? And I was very. That was the first time I ever made amends that put me at risk. And, I was great at making amends. They stopped taking my calls, but for the first couple of years I was in and out, every time I'd get sober, I'd make amends to my parents because I knew they were good for 100. I'd always make amends to my parents first. And second usually would be my ex-girlfriend because I need to show her how I've turned over a new leaf and how I'm spiritual. And I was very self-serving. And this is the first time I ever made an amends that wasn't self-serving. And it put me at risk. And I started this process of people in AA walked me through it. They had me making amends before I really did a legitimate fourth step. I'm not saying that's the way to do it. That's just my experience. I was fairly new when they started telling me that about I have to make amends to my parents. And I thought that they didn't understand that it was too late for that. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, before I took the chair and tried to break it over my dad's head, maybe back before I did that I could have made amends. Maybe before I really ripped them off for that one big time. Maybe before I really embarrassed my father in front of some of the people that he knew. Maybe before I'd took some of my grandmother's stuff and sold it. My mom didn't have a lot of my grandmother's stuff. Maybe there would have been a time, but I had to try to explain to the people in AA, it's too late. They don't even take my calls. And this, I tell you, I am delighted to this day that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous really didn't care that much for my perception of things. They didn't really care how I felt about stuff. They just wanted me to take these actions in spite of what I thought. And they first thing they said to do, we want you to start calling your mother every at least once a week. And they told me something that would have never occurred to me. They said, "We want you, don't call her Colette." I never would have thought of that. I always called Colette. They would hang up. You know, they'd go, "No, hang up." They said, "Don't call Colette." I remember the first time I called my mom. And I paid for the call. She answers the phone, and when she hears my voice, she gets agitated. She says, "Oh my God, where are you? Are you back in Pennsylvania again? Oh, what's happening? Wow, what do you want?" I said, "No, Mom, I'm not in Pennsylvania." She said, "But where are you?" I said, "I'm in Nevada." She said, "Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call." I said, "No, Mom, I paid for the call." Her voice like jumped an octave. She went, "You paid for the call?" She couldn't believe it. But she gave me that like that, man. She was just, you know, "What do you want?" She wanted to get off that phone. She didn't want to talk to me. So in the face of rejection, I'd call every week. And she was not friendly. And I guess that's right. I guess you break somebody's heart enough that loves you, I guess it makes perfect sense that they're going to be guarded and mistrustful for quite some time. Quite some time. They told me to send cards and little notes to them. They told me never miss a Father's Day, a Mother's Day, never miss their birthdays, their anniversary, Christmas. "You know, I know you don't have much money, Bob. Go get them some little thing." I remember the first Christmas. It was so pathetic. I got enough money together to buy my dad a tie. It was pathetic, a tie. I mean, if I got my dad the Taj Mahal, we wouldn't have been even. I had to give him a tie. It was so pathetic. And it lit him up. It lit him up. It was the first conversation right after that I ever had where he got on the phone and actually wanted to say something to me. He thanked me for the tie. It was almost a year of calls and little gifts and different things before they told me they wanted to come out. They were going to come out to Las Vegas. They wanted to come out and eyeball me because they're skeptical. You know, they come out to Vegas with this attitude. Here's the attitude. I can remember. I could hear it in their voice. The attitude is, you know, "We're going to come out there and we don't know if you're conning us or not. You're probably a bum, but you know, we've never been to Vegas. It won't be a complete loss." And that's really how they came out there. And they came out there with that attitude. And I met him at the airport. I took him out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife before it was now she passed away. And it was my sponsor's idea. I took him, I was a little grandiose because I feel so guilty around my parents. I took him to this really nice restaurant. I had never been to a nice restaurant, so I didn't know what a bill in a nice restaurant looked at. When we got the bill, I'm supposed to buy buying them dinner. I don't have enough money. I felt so pathetic. I had to borrow money off my sponsor to take my parents out to dinner. My sponsor says, "Why don't you take them to your home group?" I belonged to a meeting called the Floating Big Book Group at the time. Met in people's houses Friday nights. Big meeting, about 60 people, and meet in people's homes. I brought him to my home group, and what a brilliant suggestion that was for my sponsor, because my parents got to see me with you. And I've never been better than when I'm with you. They got to see me with around the old-timers. In the home group, I got sober. The old-timers took just raucous joy out of picking on the newer people. Oh my God, they just say stuff to us that would smart and then laugh like hell. Oh, I thought our difficulties and misery were the most hilarious thing they'd ever seen. And then they got to see me with the guys I run around with, and I ran with a pack of guys. We went to a lot of meetings, man. Most of those guys were still sober. We'd go to two meetings a day. We take meetings into the detox. We went out to the state prison, a bunch of us together. We ran in a pack. And we had a tremendous sense of camaraderie, the camaraderie of a fellowship in action. And then they saw me with a few of the newer guys that were at the meeting that I'm trying to help, and how I would pick on them and goof on them and laugh at their problems, because AA functions on the first rule of plumbing: crap runs downhill. The old timers goof on us, and we goof on the newer people. Yeah. And if you're fairly new, and the old timers have been goofing on you, there's hope in you sponsoring people. Pass it on. And I remember at the meeting, My parents loved it. They loved it. They laughed. Some of the things they thought were hilarious. I remember my mom tearing up. Somebody at the meeting was talking about getting their kids back. And my mom was, I remember she leaned over to my dad and she said, "This is wonderful." Right before they left, I had to meet with them in a coffee shop at the Stardust Hotel where they were staying. And on paper, I really had given a lot of thought, and I talked to my sponsor a lot about it, and I was instructed to make a list as accurately as I can of all the money I owed my father, and it was considerable. I mean, all the times where I'm facing jail if I don't pay a fine, you have to loan me the money, or the rent, I don't have the rent because I blew it, and he'd loan me the money, and the car needed transmission because I got to go to work, and he'd loan me the money. I mean, there's years of this stuff. And they told me that I couldn't wait. I had to make payments. Because I wanted to make all my financial amends, but I wanted to hit the lottery, and then I would kind of... I was a good-intentioned person. My actions were a little weak, but my intentions were very good. And they told me in AA that you sold... They said, "You sold your integrity and your self-esteem a nickel and a dime at a time. You're going to buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time." And I sat down with this list, and it was 12 and a half years of payments to my father. And I remember sitting in the coffee shop and telling him my plan about how I want to start making payments. And my dad looked at my mom, and he said to me, and he looked at me, and he said, "Rob, we don't want you to make the payments. We want you to forget about that. We just want you to stay sober. And you can continue to go to this AA thing. We don't understand it, but we just see that this is the first time that we had any hope that you were going to be all right. Just keep doing whatever you're doing. And forget about the debt." Well, my God, I just hit the recovery lottery. I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. I'm on a high, man. I'm thinking this. I like this immense thing. I'm on my way. I'm leaving the Stardust. I'm on my way to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news. Kind of thinking about other people I owe money to. Wonder if I could get them to see the light like my parents saw the light. And I get into my sponsor's office. I tell him the good news. My father says I don't have to pay, and he looks at me, he says, "It doesn't matter what your father said, you still owe him. This is your debt." And you know, there are times when you know you just got the wrong sponsor. And I said to him, what do you expect me to do? Am I sending this little check every month? He's not going to cash it. My dad's not wealthy, but they're well off. They're fine. They're secure. He's not going to cash it. And he had this saying, I just took him to the detox meeting with me. He has this saying, he still says it to this day. He said, "Well, I don't know, but a way will be shown." He said, "I don't know, but a way will be shown." Wow. People seem weird to me. I'll tell you, a way will be shown. Well, I'm working as a cashier in a store, running a cash register. My dad had this hobby that was bordered on an obsession, actually. He'd spend hours and hours collecting and cataloging and putting into boxes and books and all kinds of stuff. Silver coins and war nickels and wheat pennies and silver certificates and gold certificates. He just loved that stuff. He just loved it. And I'm running a cash register in the late 70s in Arizona. There was a lot of silver coins in circulation. There's a lot of wheat pennies, a lot of war nickels, a lot of silver certificates, and still a lot of gold certificates. And I said to my boss, I got this idea. I said to my boss, "Would you mind if I bought this stuff out of the register when it came through?" And my boss didn't care. He said, "Yeah, kid, I don't collect that stuff. Go ahead." And I started doing it with the sole intention of accumulating a bunch of it that I could give to my dad one day as a gift. Not to wipe out the debt, that's too big, that's impossible. But to accumulate something and maybe give it to him, you know, for his birthday one year, Christmas. And I just started doing that. And I was also chipping away at a couple other little events. And I'll tell you something started happening to me. And I've watched this happen to people with a consistency. From the moment I started taking action along the lines of paying this stuff back and making it right, I started getting lucky. I started having some financial windfalls come my way. I started getting raises. I eventually got changed jobs and went into some place and ended up being the manager of a store, in which I got a big bonus. And there was a guy in AA who had a moving truck, and he used to pay me $100 cash just for a couple hours helping him move furniture. And to my amazement, in a little over 4 years, I had accumulated at face value. I had a shoebox full of silver certificates and gold certificates. There were a couple times when these $100 gold certificates had come through there, and I'd have to go to my boss and say, "Can you hold this for me? It might take a week or two or three." And he'd hold it in his safe, and then I'd buy it from him. And I accumulated at face value. I had bags of quarters and all kinds of stuff. The entire value of the debt. And I was able to go back there with my daughter's mother to see my parents, and I gave my dad that stuff. And I want you to know something. I want you to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that before I gave that to my father, my dad had forgiven me. My dad loved me. And I loved him. And the amends, for the most part, a lot of people would have considered it made. There's a lot of people in AA that the verbal amends and everything, and that's as far as they would have gone, and they would have been fine with that. But when I gave my father that money, our whole relationship changed. I think prior to that, my dad loved me, but I was Bob. You know Bob. You got to make exceptions for Bob. You know, it's like, Bob's in a 12-step program. You know, Bob. Jeez, Bob. Special, it's like special bus Bob. I mean, not quite, but that, it was almost like special bus Bob, you know. And when I paid that money back to my dad, his whole perception of me changed. And I believe for the first time in his life, my father started to respect me. And I think I became a man in his eyes. And he loved me before that, no question. But it changed things. And I'm sad to tell you that he died that next year. And it was bittersweet. And it was bittersweet because we had developed a really great respect for each other and a wonderful relationship. And it was bitter because I didn't get enough of it. I wanted more of it. I wanted more of it. But I was able to fly back to Pennsylvania and be there for my mother and my sister. Something had started to happen in my family. I was becoming the person that they turned to. I didn't know that. I was becoming the pillar of the family. And I was able to bury my dad, and there were no ghosts. There was no unfinished business. There was nothing yet to be mended. My dad died, and we were even. My dad died, and he knew that I loved him, and he knew that I knew that he loved me. There was no unfinished business. I know what it's like to have someone that was dear to you die, and you have the ghosts. My grandfather died before I got sober, and I was haunted for quite some time until I eventually did what it talks about in the book and wrote the letter. Because he couldn't be seen because he was dead. And I had the ghosts of the things I did to hurt him. On the morning of the funeral of his wife of 60-some years, and what an amazing couple they were. They had a tremendous love affair for 60-some years. And on the morning of her funeral, he had to come into the guest room and find me laying on the floor with a hypodermic needle in my arm and blood. or because I had found the drugs that she was on before she died the night before. And I got to write that letter. And I got, the book says we write them an honest letter. And I, in that letter, I told him everything I would like to have been able to say to him if I could have sat over a kitchen table with him. I told him how sorry I was for doing that to him on the worst day of his life. I thanked him because sometimes amends is more than you're sorry, it's unfinished business. And I had never thanked him for how wonderful he'd been to me as a child. He was my grandpa. How his love was such an amazing thing. He had as much to do with raising me as my father, because my father was at a grueling schedule and had to travel a lot. And my grandfather was a very strong presence in my life as a kid. And how I disappointed him and broke his heart. And how he gave me money to go to college and I blew it all and never completed it. And I sent him that letter by sitting on a rock in the desert and reading it and crying and then burning it. And I had a sense of something when I did that. I had a feeling that wherever my grandfather's spirit was, he got that letter. And the reason I had a sense of that there was closure. My experience with my memories of my grandfather shifted with that letter. And they were no longer haunting, but they started to become sweet. And I have very, very fond memories of my grandfather. And there's no guilt or remorse attached to them anymore. And there was at one time. I'll tell you about one of the hardest amends I've had to make. And then we'll take a break. One of the hardest things is to make amends for stuff you do sober. You know, and the toughest amends I've had to make in my life have been for things I've done sober. You know, when you're making amends for things you did when you were drinking, well, you can kind of exonerate yourself and say, well, I was screwed up for God's sake. But what do you do as a member of AA when you're supposed to be living a program of rigorous honesty and you've been a liar, a cheat, and a thief sober? I was working in this store as a cashier. I've been working there for a little while, and I was living paycheck to paycheck. And one Thursday afternoon, I ran out of cigarettes, and I had a very strong cigarette addiction. I was three packs a day. I was a little hyper, and prior to really getting into the steps, I was a little hyper. Back in those days, and I'd light a cigarette off a cigarette often. And I ran out of cigarettes, and I don't have any money until the next day, Friday, when I get my paycheck. So we sold cigarettes. So I thought, well, I'll take a pack of cigarettes. When I get my paycheck, I'll ring it up. It seemed like a very reasonable proposition to me. I took the cigarettes, I smoked them. The next day I come into work, I get my paycheck, we cash them out of the register like we usually do. The thought goes through my mind, you know, you've got to ring those cigarettes up. And it was immediately, I love my alcoholic mind, it's so bizarre. It was immediately, I had these thoughts of, yeah, but you come early and you stay late, Bob. You really work harder than anybody else here. It's only a pack of cigarettes, for God's sakes. Don't be so anal. It's probably factored into the cost of operation. And I never rang those cigarettes up. And I opened the door and I started supporting my cigarette habit from stealing cigarettes out of work. And I don't know how I'm capable of this, but I did that for a very long period of time and never looked at it. Never looked at it. Never tried, kept sweeping under the rug as if I'm not doing anything wrong. I'd go to meetings and talk about how my rigorous program of honesty, and I just stole three packs of cigarettes that day. I don't know how you do that. That's crazy how we can do that kind of stuff. I did it. I don't even know I'm doing it. And I started getting sick. And things started happening to me that were not good. One of the things that was frightening is I was having a hard time going to meetings. You know what? It seemed like everybody at AA sounded so phony to me. You know, just full of crap. I don't understand the dynamic that unconsciously I'm projecting my judgment of me onto you. Right? I was dating a girl. I started picking her apart. I started picking everybody apart. Eventually started picking my boss apart. He was a good guy too, but I think we have that ability. I think an alcoholic that's spiritually sick could find fault with Mother Teresa. You know, I think we're just good at that. It's an art form. And I'm getting weirder and weirder. One night I get down on my knees before I go to bed, like I've been trained to doing on my knees, instead of just saying the prayer I usually say. I just yelled out. I just said, God, what the hell's going on? The moment I asked the question, the answer was evident. I got it. I got that the reason I'm on my way to my next drink, the reason I'm like leaving AA, even though I've never stopped going to meetings, the reasons I'm getting sicker here and squirrelier by the day is I'm stealing from my boss. And I'm the guy in the book that lives the double life. You know, has the stage character. I want to present to the rest of the world. I want to enjoy a certain reputation, the book says. But secretly in my heart of hearts, I know what a phony I am. I know what a liar and a cheat and a thief I am. The problem, here's the problem with all this kind of stuff. Is that I will inevitably, I cannot escape the cause and effect, I will inevitably, unconsciously feel about myself the way I would feel about someone else who had done this to me. That's the problem with this kind of stuff. And I'm inside me, I'm sabotaging my own life. And I knew what I had to do, and I'm scared. I'm afraid I'm going to drink, because I could. All of a sudden, I had this amazing clarity of what was going on. It was frightening to me. You know what was the most frightening? Is I'd been doing it for a long period of time, and couldn't see it. And then when you really see it, it's like, oh my God. I thought, how could I be doing this for so long? But I was. I knew what I had to do. I knew I had to go make amends, and it frightened me. For a couple reasons. One is that I know my boss is going to fire me. He has zero tolerance for employee theft. And retail's like that. That's just the way it is. I watched him throw a guy out of the store one time. And I'm going to be without a job. It wouldn't have been so bad if I had had the money, but I started figuring out how much it was, and it was a lot of money. I don't even have the money. I'm going to be without a job looking for work. I don't even know if I can use him as a reference. Probably not. It'd be another blank spot in my resume, and I got quite a few of those. And I'm going to have to go somewhere, and then I'm going to have to make payments, and it's going to be a while to pay this back. And then I think the most embarrassing thing is the guy I got to go face has heard me prattle on a couple occasions about my rigorous program of honesty in AA. I'll tell you, I learned something from that. Never trust anybody who tells you how honest they are. Really? I'll trust the guy that'll tell me, you know, if you get me scared enough, I'm going to lie to you. I'll trust a guy like that. But I went to him. God, I was so terrified. I went to him, and I told him what happened, he flipped out. He started yelling at me. And he was angry. And he's telling me about me, and what he's saying is hurting, but it's the truth. Because he'd been very nice to me. He'd really been very good to me. And he didn't fire me. I was amazed. And I figured out what I owed him. I added on another 10%. And then, because I would rather overkill this. I was so afraid of screwing this up. I added on another $50 on top of that. And the reason I did that is, here's the way I am. If I'm going to estimate how much money I owe you, and it's a bad estimate, it's not going to be bad in your favor. I was the guy who used to buy pounds of pot, I'll divide. You know who's going to get the bigger half if I divide? I mean, I'm just, that's just intuitive with me. That's my nature. So I added on the 10%, the extra $50, and I started paying it. And I'll tell you, I never got the cause and effect for some time. How everything, and there's a oneness in the universe. It's all connected. It's inescapable. Within 30 days of making the last payment, I was before I even made all the payments, I was very happy working there. I was not looking for another job within 30 days of making the last payment. A guy came to me, I was not looking for another job, and offered me a position, a chance for management of the biggest store of its type in Nevada. And it was an amazing offer. And I put my notice in, I went to work for that guy, and I gave him a dime for his nickel every day, and I never stole nothing from him. I never even took a ballpoint pen home. And I became, in no time, the manager of that place, which was really helping me facilitate a lot of my men's, my dad, and a bunch of other stuff. I'm in a restaurant one night at Denny's, down on the Boulder Highway, and I see my ex-boss and his wife sitting in that restaurant, the guy I had robbed and paid back. And we were good friends. I went up to him. I said, "Hey, how you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm a little down." I said, "Well, what's going on?" He said, "Well, you might have heard I was going to sell my store." And I had. I heard something about that. And I said, "You know, I had heard about that. Well, how's that going?" He said, "Well, the gaming control board, because those stores also have slots, and the liquor control board, because they also sold liquor and cigarettes. They have all these licenses." He said that they would not pass this guy on the investigation, and they wouldn't give him a license, and I got it back in my lap. And he says, "I'm a little discouraged. I really was burnt out and wanted to retire." And I stood there and I had this out-of-body experience. I heard myself say words to him. As I'm hearing them, these words are embarrassing me. I said to him, "Oh my God, I'd really like to buy your store." And I'm thinking, "Why did you say that? That's the stupidest thing. You don't have any money." And I started backpedaling. I think, "But I'm just kidding. I don't have any money. I'm just a fantasy thing." And he said to me, "So what day is your day off?" I told him. He said, "Why don't you meet me down here for lunch at noon?" And I said, "Okay." And I don't know what's going on. And I came down there. I remember walking into the restaurant. He was already there sitting in the booth. He had these papers. And I sat down and he made me a proposition. He said to me, "If you'll come back and you'll run my store, and if you can get the numbers up," he said, "the guy that took it over there for a while that couldn't get licensed really ran it into the ground. It's not making money. It's probably losing some every month." He said, "But if you can get the numbers up where it's really doing very well again," he said, "I'll let you earn yourself a piece of the action, a piece of the business out of those profits." And he said, "If you can meet," he showed me a sheet and some numbers, "you can make these numbers every year at the end of 5 years, it's yours. And you'll still have to make some payments for a little while, but it'll be yours." And I'm a guy with no education. I'm a guy who has a resume that has like telemarketing, washing dishes, selling blood, dealing drugs. You know, I'm not a rocket to start up here. You know what I'm saying? I just couldn't believe it. I said, "Absolutely, I'd love to do that." And I went to work. I gave my notice and started running that store and doing everything Chamberlain had told me to do. Chamberlain said, "Kid, you go to work for one reason and one reason only. You go there to help God's kids. Forget about yourself. You go there to be of service. Let God take care of you. You just go to work and take care of His kids." And I started doing that. I built a business on that. And I bought him out, started opening other stores, and eventually I had 5 stores and sold them. It's been quite a few years now. And I retired, I'm very, very comfortable. I don't fly around the country in a Learjet, but I'm very, very comfortable. And my daughter never has to worry about stuff. She has some security as a result of that. And it all hinged on a turning point, really, in my life. In early sobriety, where I could have maybe swept it under the rug and quit that job and went and got another job and said, "Screw them," like I have a history of doing. Or I could have walked through the fear and made the amends. I know one thing, beyond a shadow of a doubt, I would not have had that business if it wouldn't have been for that immense. I know that like I know I'm sitting here. And I've watched this in many, many people. There seems to be this uncanny thing that happens often to us. And the more afraid you are of making the amends, and the more resistance you have, the resistance comes from the ego. The more resistance you have, the greater the benefit on the other side. It always seems to be that way. See, I only ever have one battle in my life. It looks like all kinds of stuff, but I only have one battle. And that's with self-centered fear. That's the only battle. One of my favorite lines in the book is at the very end of, I think it's on page 42. And this is the line that guys like me and the RIA and a lot of us bet our lives on. It says, quite as important, the very bottom of 42, was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I'll tell you one thing and then we'll take a break. I think that I am in a battle that never goes away. And the battle is between my spirit and my ego or self. The problem is ego is louder than God. It clamors louder. It's devious, where God is a very still, small voice. That's why guys like me have sponsors. Because when I need to be connected most to God is when I'm the most disconnected to God. When I'm crazy and got a resentment or full of fear, I can't get quiet and hear God. I get quiet and hear me. Because it's loud. So I need you. And the great miracle of AA is that we're all not sick the same way on the same day. And even when two of us are sick, if one of us tries to help the other one, the moment he tries to help the other one, he gets free from the thing that was making him sick. Isn't that bizarre? And that's how this thing works. Let's take a 8-minute and 47-second break.